KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from the Excelsior.
West Portal.
Potrero Hill.
I'm from the Bayview.
Diamond Heights.
Inner Sunset.
Glen Park.
I'm a proud member of the Mission.
Coming up, as the nation continues to debate immigration policy, we'll reveal the secret history of Bay Area Italians during World War II.
She used to say in Italian, "Non abbiamo fatto niente a nessuno." We have done nothing to no one. Why is this happening?
Then we'll meet a long-lost character from San Francisco's past who set a political precedent.
He simultaneously attacked, like, corrupt businessmen in the same way that Donald Trump attacked Hillary Clinton as being a fat cad.
Hidden stories of civil liberty violations you won't learn in history class, coming up on Cross Currents. During World War II, the U.S. government incarcerated almost 120,000 Japanese Americans and their immigrant parents. What's less well known is that the government also violated the civil liberties of thousands of Italian immigrants right here in the Bay Area. Recent legislation in the U.S. Congress hopes to raise awareness about this dark period of history. KALW's Carrie Spivak brings us the story.
Now, this is old Italian neighborhood right here. That's the house I was raised in, right there.
Al Bronzini is showing me some of the places that were important to him growing up in East Oakland 80 years ago.
Boy, this is different. Wow.
But he's a little too uncomfortable to park the car, so he points things out from the driver's seat.
Fruit Bell Banana Depot is that blue building over there. And we used to unload the bananas in the back and the side by the railroad track.
Today, the building is an auto body shop, but it used to be his father's fruit market. That was back in the 30s, before the government designated his mother and father enemy aliens and the family nearly lost everything. Al's parents, Clara and Guido Bronzini, came to the United States from a town near Pisa, Italy, in the late 1920s. They came after World War I devastated Italy. There were no crops, no jobs, no future. And the fascists were gaining power. Al remembers his mother telling him fascists came to her house when she was a teenager.
And my grandfather, her father, he refused to fly the fascist flag. So they tortured my grandfather.
Clara and Guido left Italy as soon as they could. Once they arrived, America gave them everything that Italy could not. First, they bought a house in the Melrose District. Then, a refrigerator to replace the icebox, a brand new four-door Pontiac, and finally, a top-of-the-line radio. Only a few families in the neighborhood had one.
Clarity, pure, true, undistorted tone. Philco Balanced Unit Radio.
It could receive stations from overseas. And I can remember my dad listening to that radio. He loved opera music.
Mama!
And life was good. Life was better than they could have ever dreamed possible.
Life was so good that Clara and Guido put off finishing the paperwork for their citizenship. It didn't seem necessary. Italy and the United States had a great relationship, but that started to change in 1939, when Italy and Nazi Germany joined forces. Al Bronzini remembers his mother especially was torn between her love for Italy and for her new home in America.
She cried her eyes out. She just couldn't believe what was happening. And the worst was yet to come.
It came just 2 months after the United States entered the war, in December of 1941. Al was 13. He remembers he was eating dinner with his family when two policemen came to their home.
They said, Mr. Bronzini, we have to search your house. You are on the enemy alien list.
Clara and Guido were now two of the 50,000 Italian immigrants in California who were designated enemy aliens.
They searched the house, found nothing. So they said, we have to take your Philco radio.
Even flashlights, cameras, and shortwave radios were considered contraband.
She pleaded with the police, "Do not, please do not take my radio." And as she was tugging and pleading and crying, they carried it out the front door.
The government imposed a curfew and placed travel restrictions on anyone labeled an enemy alien. Al's parents couldn't go more than 5 miles from home without a permit. Clara, Guido, and the others had to join a nationwide registry and provide photos and personal information.
They had to go to the library and have their little alien book stamped every Friday.
Then, the military created prohibited zones, areas around strategic facilities like the coast and oil fields. The family's fruit market was in one of those zones.
My father received a notice that his beloved banana depot was off limits to him.
In a way, the Bronzinis were luckier than others. They got to keep their house. The prohibited zones forced other Italian immigrants from their coastal homes in Pittsburgh, Alameda, and San Francisco. The Navy confiscated boats owned by Italian fishermen. Without an income from the banana depot, Guido took work where he could find it. But the stigma of being an enemy alien followed him.
A little bit of chatter and bingo, that guy's an enemy alien. He's out of here.
For Al's mother, the growing similarities between the life she escaped in Italy and the new restrictions in America became overwhelming.
She used to say in Italian, "Non abbiamo fatto niente a nessuno. We have done nothing to no one. Why is this happening?"
It got so bad that Clara suffered a mental breakdown and was admitted into a hospital.
This is not a crazy woman. This is a woman who has been stripped of her dignity.
Al remembers one Sunday going to visit her with his father and brother. It's still hard for him to remember seeing her like this.
She was sitting on her bed in a straitjacket.
Within a year, the government lifted the restrictions on Italian enemy aliens, citing their loyalty to America. In the Bronzini family, Clara slowly recuperated, and Guido reopened the banana depot. He and Clara did become naturalized American citizens. Al says it was one of the happiest days of their lives.
They never blamed the United States for the treatment they received. They blamed themselves.
Al says his parents never spoke about what happened to them during World War II, and Al himself didn't talk about it for 50 years.
Head northwest, then turn left.
Thousands of other Italian immigrants lost even more, their freedom. They were arrested, imprisoned by armed guards, and held behind barbed wire in local detention centers.
Wow. This is really tucked away here, isn't it?
I'm with historian Lawrence DeStassi. We're going to Sharp Park, about 20 minutes south of San Francisco. I've driven Highway 1 hundreds of times, not knowing that I was passing the site of one of those former detention centers.
This was for temporary detention, mainly. There were Japanese here who were kept here until they were sent to their regular internment camps. It was also for people who were arrested on various charges.
He's talking about immigrants from Italy and some Germans, Mexicans, and Canadians, all labeled enemy aliens. Part of why I never knew this was here is because there's nothing left of the detention center. Once a 10-foot-tall fence surrounded this place, and barracks held up to 2,500 prisoners at a time. But today, it's just a flat, grassy field surrounded by eucalyptus-covered hills.
There's a presence or something that's very hard to describe, but thinking about this when there were people behind barbed wire here, you know, it's really... Now it's such a bucolic place. It's all this sort of beautiful trees and everything. But at that time, it was not bucolic at all. It was pretty upsetting for people to be held here.
Detention facilities like this were scattered throughout the Bay Area and the United States. Deeper inland, hundreds of Italian immigrants were held at internment camps. People like Costanza Ferran's father. She's 82 now, but she was only 6 when the government arrested her father and sent him to an internment camp in Montana.
What I remember are these strange men coming and taking my father away. It was It was very quick. They simply took him and left. My father was very calm. I don't think he was particularly surprised that something was going to happen because he was aware of what was happening in the world.
Costanza's dad was taken about 2 weeks after the United States entered the war. But for years before, the FBI had been secretly keeping track of people it considered potentially dangerous. Immigrants who joined Italian social clubs, subscribed to Italian newspapers, and taught in Italian language schools. Costanza's dad, Carmelo Ilacqua, was active in the Italian immigrant community, and he worked for the Italian consulate.
Many people in San Francisco were not even aware that this was happening because maybe they'd been here two or three generations.
Costanza's father was released and allowed to return home after Italy surrendered. Soon after, the United States Army contacted him, asking if he would teach Italian to their military officers.
I mean, my father really thought this was humorous. He says, "So I've been saluting the American officers, and now they have to salute me. I'm the teacher."
After the war, the government classified information about Italian enemy aliens. Generations of Americans, including Italian Americans, never knew about this. Historian Lawrence De Stasi.
It's a secret story, both to the people who went through it and to everybody else who knew nothing about it, plus the government itself who was in denial about it for almost 50 years.
Then, in the late 90s, Italian Americans, including Lawrence De Stasi, urged Congress to investigate the wartime treatment of Italian immigrants as a violation of their civil rights. Congressman Elliot Engel of New York addressed Congress on C-SPAN.
"Mr. Speaker, we must ensure that these terrible events will never be perpetrated again. The least our government can do is try to right these terrible wrongs by acknowledging that these events did occur."
They got legislation passed that made information about the wartime treatment of Italian immigrants public. And just last month, Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, who represents Silicon Valley, introduced two bills. The first would promote education about the treatment of Italian immigrants during World War II. The second would apologize for that treatment. But people interpret history differently.
"No, because what I'm doing is no different than what FDR. FDR's solution for Germans, Italians, Japanese, you know, many years
ago." "So you're for internment camps?"
During the presidential campaign, while talking to ABC's George Stephanopoulos, Donald Trump introduced a plan to ban Muslims from entering the United States by referring to the very same restrictions on Italian immigrants during World War II.
"I mean, you know, take a look at what FDR did many years ago. And he's one of the most highly respected presidents by, I mean, respected by most people. They named highways after him."
"You want to bring back policies like that?"
"No, I don't want to bring it back, George, at all. I don't like doing it at all. It's a temporary measure."
But historian Lawrence De Stasi says that what's happening today is just as wrong as the treatment of Italian immigrants during World War II.
"It was targeting people for who they were and where they were from.
And not, he says, for anything they did." In San Francisco, I'm Carrie Spivak for Cross Currents.
Carrie Spivak is a student in KALW's Audio Academy. To find more information about Lawrence De Stasi's books and links to Zoe Lofgren's legislation, go to KALW.org and click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Next month, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco will take on one of President Trump's executive orders. It's the second iteration of a proposed temporary ban on visitors from certain Muslim-majority countries. President Trump is a controversial figure, inexperienced in politics, capricious on key issues, but hardly unprecedented. In fact, a prominent San Franciscan in the 1870s has some remarkable similarities to President Trump. Author Gary Camilla has written in San Francisco Magazine about that historic figure named Dennis Kearney. KALW's Stephen Short asked him to share more.
San Franciscans may think of Dennis Kearney when they see Kearney Street, which crosses the financial district, but that's not so.
No, that's correct. The street is named after General Stephen Kearney. This is Dennis Kearney, who was a rabble-rousing demagogue who came a number of decades after the general who fought in the Mexican-American War.
That's Gary Camilla. So Stephen Kearney, Mexican-American War general, 1847. Dennis Kearney, rabble-rousing demagogue, born in 1847.
So Dennis Kearney was a very odd figure. He began as a small businessman. He ran a draying company, which meant that he had wagons that would haul goods around. And he was opposed to the workingman's cause. He was a capitalist.
One example of Kearney's anti-labor stance was his support for Chinese workers coming to San Francisco, expressly because they worked for lower wages than the resident white population. In July of 1877, a major confrontation erupted. Thousands of white working men attacked the dock where ships carrying Chinese laborers arrived. Kearney, an Irish immigrant himself, helped drive the rioters away. But soon after that, Dennis Kearney made an about-face. He devoted himself to the promotion of a political movement called the Working Men's Party of California.
He began raging violently against speculators and blood-sucking capitalists and their Chinese slaves. So he had this double attack that was very similar to Donald Trump, in which he simultaneously attacked like corrupt businessmen in the same way that Donald Trump attacked Hillary Clinton as being a fat cat and, you know, Washington establishment.
Kearney was a very popular and very persuasive speaker who quickly gained political power. And as with Donald Trump during his election campaign, Kearney didn't directly call for violence against opponents, but it happened. Remember when candidate Trump said he'd support people who roughed up protesters?
All right, yeah, get them out. Try not to hurt them. If you do, I'll defend you in court. Don't worry about it.
Kearney, like Trump, knew how to get a crowd worked up. And once they were...
He would conclude all of these speeches with his trademark closer, "The Chinese must go." And, you know, then all of the men, and they were all men in the audience, would, you know, roar their approval.
And Kearney, the man who once protected Chinese laborers, now inspired violence against them.
Hundreds and thousands of men stormed across San Francisco in these appalling, basically race riots, beating up any Chinese person that they saw in the streets, burning down Chinese laundries, just wreaking havoc. And in fact, they had to bring the police in and basically block off each end of Chinatown and prevent these thugs from going in and wreaking even more mayhem in Chinatown.
Kearney's gift for stirring up indignation wasn't solely directed at Chinese.
The most famous or infamous of his escapades was when he led a phalanx of men up to the top of Nob Hill, where the magnate Charles Crocker had built one of those enormously opulent mansions on top of Nob Hill, which many of which were clearly visible from the downtown below. And so when Kearney led his followers to the top of Nob Hill, he cited this as an example of the disgraceful arrogance of the rich. And he thundered, you know, "If I give an order to hang Charles Crocker, it will be done." And he also threatened to give him the worst beating with sticks a man ever had.
Crocker was not beaten with sticks or anything else. Maybe the mob trampled the shrubbery, but that's about it.
They were much more content to burn down the laundries of helpless Chinese who would not be protected by the police. They knew that if they actually tried to do anything to Charles Crocker's mansion, that they would get their own heads cracked.
Dennis Kearney's Working Men's Party won about a third of the seats in the 1878-1879 California Constitutional Convention.
But they, you know, didn't really succeed in getting much legislation through. But one thing that he did get through, or that he was played a key role, certainly, was the now infamous Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. Which basically froze Chinese immigration into the United States until the 1940s.
While that legislation shaped California's immigration policies, Kearney himself wasn't long for politics.
His own followers got sick of his autocratic ways and he faded from power.
Dennis Kearney returned to business, opening an employment agency.
I think the best word to describe this man overall was he was supremely opportunistic. And in that regard, that's yet another obvious parallel with Donald Trump. You know, it's really quite unclear to what degree Donald Trump actually believes almost anything that he says. He's completely opportunistic.
And that next opportunity for the rabble-rousing demagogue Dennis Kearney was, predictably, more money. He died a rich man in Alameda in 1907. In San Francisco, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
To read Gary Camilla's full San Francisco Magazine article, go to klw.org and click Cross Currents. And if you've got a hidden Bay Area history you'd like us to dig into, let us know about it. Give us a call and leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That number again, 415-264-7106. And that's it for Cross Currents today. Our team includes Nina Gensler-Debs, Olivia Henry, Leela Day, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Judy Silber, Beatrice Thomas, Andrew Stelzer, and Claire Strempel. Today's show was produced by Carrie Spivak, engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Liza Veal. Jen Chien is our managing editor, and Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by three sisters known as the Tea Sisters. This trio from Oakland credits their harmonies to, quote, hearing yourself as part of a whole. The Tea Sisters appear at the Freight and Salvage Coffee House in Berkeley this Friday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.